Acura.com. Shearer Acura, where everything matters. For well-qualified buyers, offer ends March 4th, 2013. See dealer for details.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, going in-depth with the most interesting innovators, changemakers, business leaders, politicians, and activists in Vermont and around the country. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Lake Champlain Transportation, a community leader pioneering new paths in business. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow and over 1,000 VBSR members. Here is noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. This week we're going to look at Vermont before and after Roe v. Wade. It's a look back and a look forward at a woman's right to choose in Vermont and in the country. Last month marked the 40th anniversary of the Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade that made abortion legal in the United States. But rather than settle the fight over a woman's right to choose, that fight has only intensified. State by state, abortion rights have been steadily eroded in recent years. A new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll shows that 7 in 10 Americans think that the Roe v. Wade decision should stand, and for the first time ever, a majority believes abortion should be legal in all or most cases. Despite that, according to the Guttmacher Institute, more than half of all U.S. women of reproductive age now live in a state that is hostile to abortion rights, whereas fewer than one-third did a decade ago. On this 40th anniversary of the landmark Roe v. Wade decision, it's worth recalling how far we've come in Vermont. A quick history lesson. Before Roe v. Wade, abortion was illegal in the U.S., and women who had an abortion were subject to prosecution. Nevertheless, roughly 1 million abortions per year, that's 3,000 per day, were performed at the time that it was illegal, often in unsafe and unsanitary conditions that could result in life-threatening complications for the mother. In 1970, New York liberalized its abortion laws. 2 years later, the Vermont Supreme Court overturned its law that forbid doctors from performing abortions. And a year later, on January 22, 1973, the Supreme Court legalized abortion nationwide. Our first guest today is Dr. Emma Ottolenghi, a founding physician of the Vermont Women's Health Center in the 1970s, now an international consultant on women's health for the Population Council and the World Health Organization. Welcome to the Vermont Conversation, Dr. Ottolenghi.
Thank you very much, Mr. Goodman.
Okay. Emma, tell us a little bit about Vermont before Roe v. Wade. What did pregnant women in Vermont who did not want to have a child have to do?
Well, not just in Vermont, but all over the country and in many other countries, women who are faced with an unwanted pregnancy, if it's strongly unwanted, they will seek an abortion. And before Roe v. Wade, of course, many of those abortions were unsafe. And there was many women who suffered complications and death from those abortions.
What did you see here in Vermont? Where would women go? What would they do?
Well, just before the 72 opening of the Vermont Women's Health Center, many women were referred to a New York clinic because New York had passed its legalization of abortion in 1970. They faced a lot of challenges because in New York, abortions were covered by Medicaid for poor women. But from out-of-state women, they had no coverage, so they had to have funding to be able to travel, to stay in New York, and then to have the pay for the abortion. And also, minors who were referred to New York needed to bring a quote-unquote, permission from somebody. It could be somebody like a grandmother, an aunt, or an older sister or so forth, because otherwise they would not be seen.
This was in New York?
In New York. And many women went to New York, and there were other places where they could go also, because there was, you know, a network, unspoken network, so that people knew where to refer women for a safe abortion. Some of the young women decided not to or couldn't go to one of those places, and they ended up at the Landholm in Burlington, which was really a home for pregnant young women who were not married, and where they were seen through their pregnancy, and most of the time the baby was put up for adoption.
Now, you were a general practitioner, a physician, still
yes.
are. You also saw the results of unsafe abortions.
Yes, I only had an outpatient clinic, but I did see results of unsafe abortions, because here in central Vermont, I was also working at Planned Parenthood in those days, which did not provide safe abortions yet. But they would come and see me after they had had some sort of infected abortion. They had been to somebody, or they came to me, not severely, so that they weren't in the hospital, but they were outpatient. And I, you know, treated them with antibiotics. We were fortunate that in those days we did have antibiotics, because the largest numbers of death were from trauma, using what they could find as far as instruments, or from infections, from unsafe abortions.
And what would this look like, say, in Vermont? You know, we hear the term back alley abortion. But in real terms, what was going on? Where would people go? What would they do?
If they had money, they could obtain, again, quote unquote, legal or therapeutic abortion, because there were physicians who were providing abortions, and they would manage to find a way, because abortions were legal when the health of, well, the life of the mother was threatened.
Even before Roe v. Wade.
By pregnancy, oh yes. Yeah, yeah. And also, and in many states, it was, in almost all states, it was legal. And so you could call it therapeutic abortion. You went to the hospital, you would pay the physician, because it's, poorer women had no alternative, such as this one, mostly.
And then for people who couldn't afford that, what would they do?
Well, in those days, as I said, they were referred to where they could obtain an abortion, even in states where it wasn't legal. There was a group of clergymen who called themselves Clergy Concerned that really had all the networks identified, and through the phone they could make an appointment for somebody, and they also raised funds to help the poorer women get there and get their abortion. So abortion deaths in Vermont, I don't think I ever heard of one when I was here. It wasn't many years that I was here, but I don't think that I ever heard a death.
And so how would, for the illegal abortions and the self-administered ones, what were people doing, you know, what?
Well, there is the well-known coat hanger, which is a symbol more than anything else, because they would use knitting needles, they would use poisonous solutions in the vagina, and whatever came to hand. Some women used broken glass, and you can just imagine what that did.
Tell me about septic wards. What were they?
Well, these were special wards in hospitals. They were in isolation, and it was specifically for women with not just septic abortions, but with infected uteri from any reason. And they were treated with IV antibiotics, because they existed before that. They went there and most likely died.
So we're speaking about infections that would result from unsanitary abortions.
Exactly, exactly.
And these would be large wards, wouldn't they?
In Vermont, not so large, because Vermont is a small place and everything is sort of contracted to small numbers. But there was a septic ward for OBGYN. In those days, it was the Mary Fletcher. It was not joined with the Allen yet. And I have a good friend who's a obstetric gynecologist of my same age. And she described she went to New York for her internship in 1970. And when she got there, it was a month before New York legalized abortion. And she said that she was in a public hospital. And the septic ward probably had 25 or 30 women. Every bed was always occupied. And what was miraculous was that 2 months after the legalization, the ward was converted to something else. They didn't need it anymore.
Abortions were now being performed safely.
Exactly.
And people were not
exactly
having these life-threatening infections.
Yeah.
So let's talk about when the change came in Vermont. There was a lawsuit, Beecham versus Leahy.
Leahy and Jeffords.
Leahy and Jeffords, okay. Tell me about that lawsuit. What was it?
Well, it's an interesting story, the most I can make of it. There was a clause in the Vermont Constitution, 1849, which stated that the legislature could not interfere when their interference would cause a loss of rights for the person. It didn't say anything else, but among those things then, they detailed things, and abortion was among those, that a woman had basic protection if she was seeking an abortion. But if she went to a physician or a trained practitioner, in those days they were all physicians, he could face 10 to 30 years in prison for performing an abortion.
So it was legal for a woman to ask, but illegal for a doctor to perform.
That's correct. So her doctor, who was a resident at the hospital in Burlington, and her, they both sued.
Now, this is Dr. Jack Beecham.
That's correct.
Who was a OBGYN.
He was the chief resident. He was not in private practice then. He was still a resident.
And he actually asked his patient to sue him, right?
The patient came to him and said, I'm pregnant and I want an abortion. And he said, you know, if I give you an abortion, then I could end up in jail, and I can't do that. So we need to really clarify how a woman can have an abortion when she is threatened with loss of well-being, but no physician will do it in Vermont because they don't want to end up in jail. So they brought a suit, which went up to the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court of Vermont.
Of Vermont, yes. And in January of 72, the Supreme Court agreed with Dr. Beecham and the woman who was pregnant that if it's legal for her to have an abortion, then she needs to have a practitioner do that abortion safely. And so it didn't say that abortion was legal. It just said that abortion was no longer illegal for a practitioner to perform.
So for a year, from January 1972 to the following January, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, there was a gray area in Vermont.
And it still is, I think.
Tell me what happened following the Vermont Supreme Court decision. There was a meeting at what is now the Unitarian Church in Burlington.
And it was already the Unitarian Church in Burlington.
And who came to that meeting? How many people?
We had over 100 people, and it was about the Supreme Court law, to go back a bit, was the opponents tried to have it review their decision, and in February the Supreme Court said no, they will not review it because they had made a decision that they were still in agreement. But I think at the end of March, like a month later or something, there was a lot of movement from activists in different areas. These activists were women's groups. There were providers, health providers, mostly doctors. I think all doctors from the health side. There were people who were in the administration of Planned Parenthood, that Planned Parenthood was not going to start doing abortions at that point. There were academics, there were lawyers, and a clergy that had been referring, and many others, interested people. We all met in the Unitarian Church.
And the decision was made to open a women's health center that would provide...
It was called a freestanding. The decision at that point was to open a freestanding clinic for women's health, which included abortion.
When did that clinic open?
It opened in September of 1972. At that meeting in the church, after it was a lot of discussion, and it was a self-selected group of people in the church. There wasn't, the opponents weren't there. I don't know why, but they weren't there, or they weren't vocal. So the decision was to open this clinic. And then so committees were formed, because you had to find a locale. You had to make sure that there were providers.
And you and Dr. Judy Tyson were
the physicians. That's correct. We were the first physicians who were house physicians, because we had two OBGYNs from the university who were very pro-safe abortion, who were the ones who did the abortions for the first few months and trained us how to do them.
And what was it like in those first months of the Vermont Women's Health Center? Were there a lot of women coming?
The first week, very few. So we had to declare ourselves open, and we drew each other's blood a day after the Free Press announced that there was this clinic. It wasn't just well-known everywhere. It was in Colchester.
And that story in the Free Press was a surprise to you. It sort of
yes.
got you going sooner
yes.
than you had
yes.
planned to go.
So we just drew our blood, each other's blood, and we declared ourselves open. And at first there were few abortion clients, women, but very soon it just, you know, it was a fact. We were open, and we were doing abortions about 3 times a week, 3 days a week, then 4 days a week, but we were doing other services also. And like, we had a bus full of women from Quebec every week on a certain day that we would not make appointments for Vermont women, because they just took all our time that day.
And what kind of women came?
Everybody. Literally everybody. Married, unmarried, young, older, not old, but older. And every religion. We asked their religion, but they didn't have to tell us, but we had just as many Catholics as Protestants. Color, well, you know, Vermont was pretty uniformly white, but we did have the odd colored person, woman who came also. It was everybody, poor, less poor.
And in fact, one of the people who was quite helpful in the early days was the Catholic nun who was head of Trinity College, is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
What was her name?
Sister, I can't think of her name right now.
That surprised me when I heard that.
You heard that, yes.
Did
she
it
was
surprise,
fabulous.
Did it no, surprise you?
No, because she was a well-known feminist in Vermont before that.
You have now since been working around the world doing women's health work. What is the main focus of your work?
Well, one of the main foci in my work has been so-called post-abortion care, which is care for women who have undergone an illegal, unsafe, mostly unsafe abortion, and are directed to the hospital when the abortion is not quite completed. They're safer than they used to be, but they're still not totally safe, because women now can do it in a safer way.
Is abortion illegal in many? You've been to something like 50 countries working for WHO and the Population Council.
Mostly for the Population Council, yes.
Is it illegal in most of those countries, abortion?
Oh, there's still many countries where it's illegal. Of course, you know, India, it's legal. And China, it's legal. And in Africa, in South Africa, it became legal not that long ago, 5 or 6 years ago. In Asia, in Nepal, it became legal very recently. So there's a movement towards legalization. And in Latin America, the only place is Mexico City, not Mexico country, and Cuba.
Emma, you are now 77, and you've seen this debate and this issue really come full circle. What are your concerns for the future?
My greatest concern is that the morality, so-called, has really trumped all the evidence that shows that women will have abortions, whether they're legal or not, and that if they have them in an unsafe way, they die. That's well known. There's the data to prove that. And yet, there are some people who are eroding the ability of women to seek safe abortions every year, more and more. And that's a huge concern. But what that brings to me is that the younger generations, the women who are now, let's say, 18, 25, 30, 35, only came to know about abortion when it was perfectly safe and it was perfectly accessible. And they assumed that it always was and that it always will be. And in Vermont, we're pretty lucky that we have no restrictions.
Well, let's turn now to Representative Jill Krawinski. Jill is a Vermont state representative from Burlington and also director of public affairs for Vermont for Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. Jill Krawinski, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me on.
Jill, let's pick up where Emma Ottolenghi is leaving off, and that is the state of a woman's right to choose in Vermont. Right now, nationally, 90% of all counties in the U.S. don't have abortion providers. What is it like in Vermont for women who seek access to abortion services?
Well, in Vermont, the barriers that I think a lot of women face have to do with access to transportation to get where providers are. We have providers across the state, from Burlington, Barry to Rutland, but that is something that we hear is a barrier. So I think that we have work to do to expand our network of providers across the state, but also help knock down some of the barriers around transportation, because, as you know, being a rural state, public transportation is not widely accessible in all corners.
What are some of the other challenges to abortion services, both in Vermont and elsewhere in New England, in the Northeast?
Well, you know, there are kind of separate categories. Right now, you have the legislative attack and opportunities to expand access in state houses. But one thing that I would love to talk a little bit about specifically is around access, literally, for patients to get into healthcare centers. So let me tell you a story about the Burlington Patient Safety Zone. A couple years ago, we moved our health center from Mansfield Ave to St. Paul Street in Burlington. And when we did that, the space between the greenbelt and the sidewalk in the front door was dramatically different. And we saw that protesters becoming much more aggressive towards our patients and staff and really trying to get access to patients before they came into our health center for services, and not just abortion services, but contraceptive services as well, primary and preventative care, working really hard to push them back and to have them turn away. And so in response to that, we worked with City Council, the Burlington City Council and the mayor, to see if we could get an ordinance passed that would create a 35-foot safety zone, also known as buffer zones, from our front entrance and from our driveway entrances. We went through that process. It took about 4 months, I think, from start to finish, and the council was extremely supportive, a very strong vote, 13 in favor, 1 opposed, to enact the safety zone. And now we started to see the patient safety zone in effect. It's marked, it's labeled with signs, and police are starting to educate and enforce it with protesters. And it's really heartbreaking when you hear stories from patients who are coming in with their partner. They want to have a privacy. They want to be able to get in and talk to their provider. And instead, they're being approached and giving the misinformation about healthcare services, but also just feeling like their personal space has been violated. And so now we're watching to see how this unfolds with the protesters and our patients, and we're getting a good response from patients that they say they feel more safe.
Okay, well, Jill Krawinski, we're going to take a break here for the news, and we'll come back and join you, and also we'll be bringing in another guest, Lynn Paltrow. Stay tuned here on the Vermont Conversation.
Next time you open up your wallet, take a closer look. Ask yourself, does your money have values? At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we believe that money can have value and values. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we value Vermont. We make loans that put Vermonters back to work, supporting local businesses, farms, and food. Our loans build homes and support organizations that provide essential services like childcare. When you invest with the Vermont Community Loan Fund, you are investing in Vermont. You decide how much to invest, how long to invest, and the interest rate you'll earn. For 25 years, we've helped Vermont families, businesses, foundations, faith-based groups, and other folks like you invest in Vermont for Vermont. That's money with value and values. The Vermont Community Loan Fund, putting your money to work for you and for Vermont. Learn more at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
AP Update. I'm Rita Foley. The president's putting the pressure on Republicans as the deadline for those spending cuts approaches. It's March 1st. Our Jerry Bodlander's at the White House, where there's a new strategy.
In an effort to increase the pressure on congressional Republicans to strike a deal that will avoid the upcoming across-the-board spending cuts, the president is localizing his approach. In interviews with 8 television stations, the White House says the president will focus on the harmful local impacts of the sequester if an agreement isn't reached. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Speaker John Boehner says the president has not identified enough spending cuts to replace the automatic ones. Jerry Bodlander at the White House.
The Defense Department, meanwhile, is warning that it may have to furlough most of its 800,000 civilian workers if the spending cuts take effect as planned. The defense secretary says he's notified members of Congress. AP Update. I'm Rita Foley.
It's Twin City Subaru's Washington's birthday sales event. This is Chris Davis, General Sales Manager at Twin City Subaru, and I'm excited to tell you of the unbelievable savings during our Washington birthday sale. Like a 2013 Subaru Legacy with symmetrical all-wheel drive, cruise control, air conditioning, and power windows for just $18,999.
So let's trade keys!
Looking for something bigger? How about saving thousands on a new Subaru Outback with Subaru's award-winning safety and economy?
So let's trade keys!
Still want more? We're offering up to 0% for 63 months as well on select Subarus. That alone can save you hundreds.
So let's trade keys!
Still not enough? Save up to $7,000 on a 2013 Subaru Tribeca with navigation and moonroof. But hurry, only one left at this incredible savings. Now come on, that's an incredible deal.
So let's trade keys!
Stop by and visit the area's top Subaru dealership today during Washington's birthday sales event going on now at Twin City Subaru, located exit 7 off of I-89 on the Berlin Mall Road, or 24/7 at TwinCitySubaru.com.
This Saturday morning, tune into Radio Vermont's pioneer radio voice, The Old Squire, with thoughts on life and the living of it in northern New England. A presentation of L.W. Greenwood and Sons East Randolph. Rural Vermont families have relied on L.W. Greenwood for high-quality farm equipment since 1929. Vermont's family-owned and operated L.W. Greenwood & Sons, Route 14, East Randolph, lwgreenwood.com. That's The Old Squire, this Saturday morning.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is pleased to make the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available, along with Lake Champlain Transportation, a community leader pioneering new paths in business. People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. National Life Insurance. For more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint and the over 1,000 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're talking this week about Vermont before and after Roe v. Wade, the landmark abortion rights decision that this is the 40th anniversary year of. And just before the break, we were speaking with Representative Jill Krawinski, who is a Vermont state rep from Burlington and also director of public affairs for Vermont for Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. Jill, I just wanted to finish by asking you, what happens in Vermont if a new U.S. Supreme Court were to overturn Roe v. Wade?
That is a great question, and this has come up several times because there's confusion about a court case and an old statute that's on the books in Vermont. And right now, if Roe v. Wade was overturned, it would be technically legal in our state, but there would be a lot of gray area open to challenge, and we would see a lot of I'm sure court activity to clarify what our stance is. And because of that confusion, there are a group of legislators who are in the process of introducing a bill that would codify Roe v. Wade in Vermont.
Okay, well, Jill Krawinski, I want to thank you. Jill Krawinski is a state rep from Burlington and director of public affairs in Vermont for Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. Our next guest is Lynn Paltrow. She is founder and the executive director of the National Advocates for Pregnant Women and the author of a much-talked-about article that came out in January called Roe v. Wade and the New Jane Crow, Reproductive Rights in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Lynn Paltrow, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Lynn, can you give us a picture of the state of a woman's right to choose nationwide?
Well, that's hard to answer in a way. Roe v. Wade is a decision that's still on the books. As originally decided, it recognized that women have a fundamental right to decide whether or not to terminate their pregnancies. Later Supreme Court decisions said that Roe has been sensibly relied upon to also protect women's decisions to go to term, to not have somebody interfere with that decision. And we presume that women, including women who become pregnant, are fully protected under the United States Constitution. Our research, looking at the arrests and forced interventions on pregnant women in the United States between 1973 and 2005, the study upon which the Roe v. Wade piece comments, has found that post-Roe anti-abortion measures and so-called pro-life feticide laws are increasingly, and even without direct legal authority, being used to deprive pregnant women, whether they intend to end their pregnancies or to go to term, of their physical liberty and their civil rights.
And this is what you refer to as the new Jane Crow. Tell us a little more about what you mean by that term.
Well, no state has passed a law, a statute, that makes it a crime for a woman to go to term in spite of a drug problem. No state has a law that says upon becoming pregnant, you lose your status as a person under the Constitution. And personhood measures, these laws that are being proposed that would treat fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses as separate persons, have not yet directly passed. Voters in Colorado defeated that measure. Voters in Mississippi defeated that measure. But what we're seeing is that these kinds of measures that are often described as ones that will just affect abortion, the personhood USA says their goal is to end the injustice of abortion, what they are actually doing and what we are already seeing is putting into place a separate and unequal system of law in which women who become pregnant are treated with a second-class status who and are subjected to government control through the criminal justice system and the civil child welfare system and the courts in general, and disproportionately so for African American women. And if I may, I think it'll help to give some examples. We see cases in which, for example, a Michelle Greenup in Louisiana goes to the hospital because she's bleeding, and they suspect that she's given birth, had a stillbirth or given birth and not taken proper care of the baby. They interrogate her. They call the police. They interrogate her repeatedly until they coerce the confession out of her in which she says she gave birth and let the baby die. She sits in jail on murder charges for over a year before her lawyers are able to get her medical records showing that when she was 11 weeks pregnant, and neither she nor her physician knew she was pregnant, she went and got a shot of Depo-Provera, a contraceptive, which, if given once you are pregnant, can cause an early miscarriage, which is what she experienced. But here's an example of a woman who did not seek to end her pregnancy, who went to a hospital for health care, and is treated as if she is a murderer. Recently, a woman in Tennessee, I mean, just a few weeks ago, was in a single car accident. Police came and they tested her to see if she was drunk. She was well below the limit for driving under the influence, and yet they arrested her. Why? Because she told them she was 4 months pregnant, I'm sure because she was worried about her baby. So they arrested her for driving under the influence and child endangerment of her four-month-old fetus. With this police officer, not with true authority of law, but believing, based on all the stuff that's being said and the various things that are being passed, that there's a separate and unequal law for pregnant women so that it's a crime to drive while you're not intoxicated. And one more example in Indiana, Bebe Shue, a woman in Indiana, was 33 weeks pregnant when she became so despondent, so depressed, in part because the man who fathered this baby abandoned her, that she attempted suicide. It is not a crime in Indiana to attempt suicide. It's understood, as in every state in the country, that this is a health issue. Yet she survived that attempt, but her baby did not. She has been charged with murder and attempted feticide, and we have not been able to get the courts in Indiana to prevent her from being forced to go to trial. So what Indiana is saying is, for you, pregnant women, there is a set of separate and unequal laws so that you are not allowed to be human and experience depression and suicidal ideation. You are supposed to be able to put aside all of that until after you've given birth.
And can you tell us a little bit about the case of Amanda Kimbrough, who faces up to 10 years in Julia Tutwiler Prison in Alabama, a place that I know has been cited by the federal court system or the federal correctional system as being having a number of human rights violations because of the conditions there. And now the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that because fertilized eggs are no different from children, what is her case about?
Well, I think her case really reflects what we're talking about. Alabama some years ago passed something called the Chemical Endangerment of a Child Law that was quite explicitly passed to punish adults who bring children to places like methamphetamine labs. The statute, that there's clear legislative history that says this is about adults bringing children to dangerous places. It is not about pregnant women giving birth. Yet, because of the political and cultural environment we're in, that law has almost never been applied in the way it was intended. Rather, hospitals have reported women who've given birth to babies who've tested positive for a variety of illegal drugs, including marijuana, and have them arrested for the crime of chemical endangerment of a child. Her attorneys and my organization, National Advocates for Pregnant Women, with the Drug Policy Alliance, filed an amicus brief on behalf of something like 47 leading medical groups that said you can't interpret the law this way. That's not what it was intended for. And if you do threaten women with arrest because of health problems they experienced during pregnancy, because they didn't have an abortion and they go to term, you're going to undermine the health and well-being of babies as well as violate the rights of pregnant women and families. courts in the past, we tried to stop this from going on. The case went all the way up to the Supreme Court of Alabama, and as you correctly noted, in the guise of something lawyerly called plain meaning interpretation, they said, look, we don't have to look at anything about what this law is really intended to do. We don't have to look at what its impact will be or its constitutional impact. It said the word child in Alabama, and really for every statute, includes fertilized eggs. And because all they did was decide that the word child includes fertilized eggs, what they have done is create, not only penalized Amanda Crimbrough and other women who sought to carry their pregnancies to term in spite of what might have been a drug problem, they have also now made it a separate and unequal system of law so that a woman cannot, pregnant woman cannot now legally receive even a prescribed controlled substance. She cannot legally obtain methadone treatment, the federally recommended treatment for women who are dealing with particularly opiate addiction problems. She cannot get pain medication, no matter how much pain she's in. And we believe that controlled substances are sometimes used as part of epidurals. So in the guise of interpreting one word, they have created essentially a personhood measure for the state of Alabama. And what that means for Amanda Kimbrough is, and many other women, we have identified at least 70 cases in which women who've sought to go to term, most of them have given birth to healthy babies, are now charged under this crime that can send them to this horrific prison that denies human rights, separates mothers from children that they already have, that they could care for, in a manner that is the antithesis, I think, of a culture of life.
And so we have a situation here where abortion is technically legal in the United States, thanks to Roe v. Wade. But you're describing a situation where these personhood laws, laws that essentially endow full status of persons on fetuses, are essentially undermining or kicking the legs out from under the right to a safe and legal abortion. How widespread is this? How much of the country are we seeing this going on in?
Well, I think partly we're trying to change the conversation and the framework. So the question you asked is a very good one. But what we're trying to say is that we tend to focus only on the impact of various laws, on whether it will, you know, undermine the right to choose abortion or not. And what we're seeing is that it is about abortion, but it is also about women who have no intention of ending their pregnancies, women who want to go to term, women who disagree with their doctors about whether they have to have cesarean surgery or not. All pregnant women are at risk of losing their status as persons under the law. So that, yes, technically abortion is still legal. Technically, you are still a full person once you become pregnant. We're now talking about asking people to ask their legislators to vote on whether they support a proclamation that women upon becoming pregnant retain all of their civil and human rights throughout pregnancy, labor, and delivery. What what happens in this country is that we sort of think that there are two different kinds of women and we need different kinds of law. There are the women who have abortions and end their pregnancies and the women who continue to term and give birth. The reality is they are all the same women, just at different moments in their lives. Something I learned from a Vermont Planned Parenthood clinic health care provider. 61 to 70% of women who have abortions are already mothers. 84% of all women by the time they're in their 40s have gotten pregnant and given birth. So that laws that affect any group of women, whether it's in the disguise of just limiting abortion or in the guise of treating fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses as if they're completely separate from the pregnant woman who's carrying, nurturing, and sustaining them, will be used to empower the state to deprive all pregnant women of their fundamental rights to physical liberty, meaning not to be locked up, bodily integrity, not to have a court order forcing them to have cesarean surgery, as has happened to some women, not to be denied their religious observances, including refusing certain medical procedures, the right to bodily integrity, to not be forced to undergo medical exams, the right to due process of law, not to have courts called in while you're in labor to make decisions without any semblance of due process.
One of the striking things you do in your article, Roe v. Wade and the New Jane Crow, is you place this conversation in the context of the era of mass incarceration that we are in now, where 1.5 million people are in U.S. prisons now, the highest ever in our history. And to quote from your article, you write, "This new era of mass incarceration, which is largely accepted by the public, defended by an army of lobbyists and justified by a war on drugs, deeply rooted in America's history of slavery and racism, makes it far more likely today than in 1973 that if Roe is overturned, women will themselves be arrested and jailed. It is also likely that women having or considering having abortions will be subject to far more government surveillance than in the past." So what is the nexus between this age of mass incarceration and this era when we're seeing really a very steady assault and erosion of women's reproductive rights?
Well, I think it should be a wake-up call. I mean, one of the claims made by groups that oppose abortion is, oh, don't worry, if we succeed, only doctors will go to jail, which is bad enough. And they claim that before Roe, the women themselves were never arrested. That's actually not true. Some women were themselves arrested, including a woman in Florida named Shirley Wheeler, who was charged with manslaughter after she attempted, she had an abortion that was actually recommended by a physician. And while it's true that women in general were not the ones who were targeted for arrest, doctors were more often targeted for arrest, the truth, as you indicated, is in 1973, very few people in any circumstance were being arrested and thrown in jail. The clear truth is that if Roe is overturned, and we're already seeing it, women who have abortions are going to be arrested, and not just for having an illegal abortion, a crime that usually before Roe carried a sentence between 2 and 10 years. They are, as we are seeing around the country, going to be charged with murder. And indeed, the judge who wrote the opinion in Alabama said, look, all I'm doing is interpreting the word child, wrote a concurring opinion with himself, I do not make this up, in which he laid out the fact that women that all, looked at all of these different anti-abortion laws and feticide laws and measured, said Roe should be overturned so that we can arrest pregnant women, whatever they do, whether they continue to term or end a pregnancy. In fact, in Idaho, in the last few years, a woman was arrested for having an abortion. She lived in a part of Idaho where where there were no abortion providers. In order to have, she already had 3 children. She didn't feel she could responsibly have another. She would have had to driven to Salt Lake City probably more than once in order to have an abortion with a provider. So she couldn't afford to do that. She found medication online that enabled her to safely end her pregnancy, but when it was found out by a friend or a neighbor, it was reported to the police and she was arrested. We have documented a case in which a judge, a woman who was arrested for something, she was part of some kind of small crime, and she was supposed to be released on probation. When she asked the judge to release her as soon as possible so she could have an abortion, the judge kept her imprisoned to prevent her from having an abortion. So we know that the tools exist now to hold people, to arrest people. There had been kind of a check on the desire to arrest people. Women weren't particularly weren't going to jail. Now we have a system that is hungry for people to fill jails and prisons, and really very little moral constraint on the idea of the people who would be we are putting in jail and already are, in terms of women, are overwhelmingly mothers.
My guest today on the Vermont Conversation is Lynn Paltrow, the executive director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women. Lynn, how do you square, I mentioned earlier in the intro to the show, that a new Wall Street Journal poll shows that 70% of Americans think that Roe v. Wade decision should stand, and for the first time ever, a majority believes abortion should be legal in all or most cases, and yet you are describing a situation where It seems there has just been a constant attack and erosion of these rights. How do you square the public opinion being for abortion rights and the rise of all these laws that restrict it?
Well, I think what here are the two things. One is that what the last election cycle happened, and perhaps if our research is also helping to expose this, is that people, I think, really believed that it was possible to limit access to abortion. They were very successful in sort of not saying we're trying to end it for all women and claiming that if we do, women aren't going to go to jail. Very reassuring that these were sort of very small, incremental measures to restrict abortion. And what we saw in this last election cycle is that when you pull the mask away, you have people talking about legitimate rape. You have people talking about a proposal in New Mexico, I believe, to require a pregnant woman who's been raped to continue her pregnancy so as not to tamper with the evidence of the rape. You see something other than just a debate about when, where, and who can have an abortion, and a discussion that really includes all pregnant women and how our country views them. And I think the polling that you're seeing is a reflection of the fact that people are starting to understand that this is not just a debate about abortion or certain abortions in certain places at certain times, but really a debate about the status of all women and whether or not they are going to be treated as, considered, and supported as full persons. So the question of personhood is really now being understood as being about women, most of whom are mothers, most of whom are entrusted to give birth to the next generation of our taxpayers, and that people really don't want to see the abortion issue or anything else used to create a second-class status for pregnant women, one that we see over and over again is used first and foremost to undermine African-American motherhood, something that's been going on since slavery in this country, and that starts there and also includes other particularly low-income women, but affects all of us and how as a society we view the women who give birth to the next generation.
Lynn, you've been working on this issue, the issue of reproductive rights, reproductive justice, for many years. What surprises you most about where we are today in 2013, and where do you find hope for this issue moving forward?
Well, I think if, as a movement, we had been doing everything we could for the last 40 years and we were kind of in the position we were in today, I would feel very badly. But there's a lot of things we haven't done. There's been a tendency, for example, to treat the middle of the country as kind of a flyover area. You know, those people there, they're too conservative, they're too fundamentalist, they're never going to support us, they're never going to support, you know, women's personhood and reproductive rights and justice. But I'm just back from Oklahoma at the third annual Take Root Reproductive Justice in the Red States Conference, and it turns out if you build it, they will come. In Norman, Oklahoma, at Oklahoma University, 200 mostly young people came to learn about, be inspired about, learn how to be active in defending reproductive and social justice. I also think that as people come to understand, you know, and this is true for people who identify, many individuals who identify as pro-life, that they have been raised to believe, to value, to treat unborn children as, you know, fully, to value them and to oppose abortion. But when they find out that what's going to happen if their beliefs are put into law as opposed to reflected in values and religious and ethical beliefs, that women are going to go to jail, that women they know are going to go to jail, they actually are not willing to support the laws that will do that. And I'm also hopeful because, you know, I'm a realist. Social change does not come about in 10 years or even 40 years. Most people forget that the notion of discrimination against women was not even recognized by the Supreme Court as prohibited under the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause until 1972, the first time in all of U.S. history that said discrimination against women is prohibited, is protected by the Constitution, not until 1972. So this idea of women's equality that recognizes equality has to exist even where there is difference, even though women are not the same as men, as they have the capacity for pregnancy. It's really in its infancy. So we are in a point of particular backlash for the gains that have been made, but we are also at the beginning of a very important movement in history that we will win, but it is one that will occur over the course of lifetimes of work, and I hope your listeners will participate in that work.
Well, Lynn Paltrow, I want to thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Lynn Paltrow is the founder and executive director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women. That'll do it for this week's Vermont Conversation. Tune in next Wednesday at 1 o'clock, where we'll be looking at how Vermont's cutting-edge ideas on energy and energy efficiency are being exported to the world. Thanks, and I'm David Goodman for the Vermont Conversation.
You have been listening to The Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when, once again, Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members bring you David Goodman with this special program. It's also made possible by Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. And Lake Champlain Transportation, a community leader pioneering new paths in business.
And you're listening to locally owned and operated 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier, the friendly pioneer, serving the kingdom at FM 101.9 from Island Pond.
AP Radio News.